This episode of Gunblog Varietycast brought to you by LawOfSelfDefense.com. Go to LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety to learn about your state's self-defense laws. Sign up for one of their online or in-person seminars or buy the book Law of Self-Defense and get 10% off when you use the discount code VARIETY at checkout. That's LawOfSelfDefense.com/variety. Sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 41. Back to the Gunblog Variety Cast. I'm your host Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns, Cars, Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
And all the kids are still trying to kill me. I've had about 3.5 hours of sleep.
Oh man.
Fun times.
You're not making me really miss the idea of being a father.
Yeah, I'm in the really like crappy part right now.
My dad insists it gets better. And now we're sounding like one of those pro-gay commercials. It gets better.
Later is longer.
Well, if you live long enough, apparently it's pretty cool. Well, let's start with a tactical dog and fitness report. 31.1 dog walking miles, and I did another run on Thursday. It's more of a run walk, really. 13-minute, 10-second miles for 3 miles.
Well, pretty good. So you remember how last week I said I had like really bad athlete's foot and I wanted to cut my foot off?
Yeah.
So turns out it actually almost came to that.
Oh.
Yeah, so I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but so I got, I had athlete's foot, and then the day after I had the open source and the athlete's foot, I found myself unknowingly standing in raw sewage, barefoot. Yeah, so the foot really did get infected, and so when I woke up on Saturday morning, my foot was all swollen up like a football. It was awesome, but I'm on antibiotics now, and I'm okay. Needless to say, there has been no running.
Ew. Well, now it's time for blue collar prepping with that bratty kid sister of the gun blogosphere, Aaron Paulette. Today, Aaron's going to talk to us about hurricane preparedness.
Come on, every pony. It's time for blue collar prepping with Aaron Paulette.
Well, it's June, Aaron, and you know what that means.
Welcome to hurricane season. Yes, it's that magical time of year when humidity climbs into the triple digits along the Gulf Coast, and we all start looking for the next Andrew or Katrina that will wipe us off the map for the next 6 months.
Well, I live far enough inland that I'm not really worried about hurricanes. But what advice can you give to the people who live along the coasts?
Lots. More than can be told in this week's segment. I've written several blog posts about it, though, and I highly suggest any listeners along the East and Gulf Coasts follow the show notes and read them. But here are the most important points. For the past few weeks, I have talked about weather and the importance of staying informed and aware of developing situations. This is absolutely critical when it comes to hurricanes. My storm tracker of choice is a webpage called Storm Pulse, which not only gives you a phenomenal amount of detail for tracking and predicting hurricanes, but also tracks other forms of severe weather like tornadoes, floods, and blizzards. Best of all, it's free to use, although you will need to create a throwaway LinkedIn account to access most of the site's features. But between that, the internet and broadcast media, and the weather app of your choice, you ought to be properly informed. Second, and just as important as staying informed, is to listen to the professionals. When they tell you to get out, you get out. In fact, if you think that it's going to be nasty, get out early and avoid the rush. The very last place you want to be when severe weather hits is stuck in gridlock between interstate exits. Now, if you do need to evacuate, have multiple evacuation routes in case the situation changes. Make sure that every car has a map or atlas in it, and pre-plan what to do in case you get separated from your family during an evacuation. I go into this and more in greater detail in my blog posts, so again, please read them. Finally, if you do decide to bunker down and wait the storm out, which I don't recommend for anything Category 3 or greater if you're in a hurricane state, and if you're in a state that isn't prepared for it, like New York wasn't prepared for Sandy, then I don't recommend weathering it out at all, then you'll want to make sure your house is ready for all the wind and weather that's coming. A few months back, I talked about waterproofing your house and making sure your home is not in a floodplain. This is super important if you live in a coastal area, because the storm surge is actually the most dangerous part of the hurricane. If you don't know what storm surge means, it's just a fancy way of saying that, oh yeah, hurricanes also cause flooding. In addition to flooding and high winds, hurricanes also spawn tornadoes up to F4 in strength. F4 means between 160 and 200 miles per hour, also known as house, what house, or why is my car flying? So make sure you have a proper storm shelter, preferably underground, or that you can get to one. Now, reinforcing your house is a great idea, don't get me wrong. Your home is an investment and you want to protect it. But don't be under the delusion that some plywood over the windows is going to keep you safe. You're going to need far more than that to make sure that the roof doesn't come off in high winds. You'll also want to secure anything in your yard that can become a projectile, like lawn furniture or the aforementioned car. If you don't have a garage where you can put it, then you'll want to put it a place where it won't damage other homes. Finally, if you plan to ride out the storm, you do need to understand that in the aftermath, you may very well be without water, power, and community services like police and EMTs. You will need to be self-sufficient until order can be restored, which can easily take a week or more. Make sure you have fuel for vehicles and generators, have enough food and water for everyone, and have a means of purifying water if you run out, and likely you will if this lasts for more than 1 week. You're also going to need lots of batteries and at least one flashlight per person to get you through the nights without power. In conclusion, I'm going to reiterate this. If you think you might need to evacuate, do it before the storm.
All right, Aaron. It was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Felons behaving badly. Man arrested in shooting death. A Winston-Salem man was arrested Thursday in connection with the shooting death of a man whose body was found in a vehicle Wednesday. Suspect 37 of the 2400 block of Collins Street is charged with first-degree murder in the death of victim, Winston-Salem police said Thursday. Suspect was arrested in Greensboro by the U.S. Marshals Joint Task Force and members of the Greensboro and Winston-Salem Police Departments. No bond or court date has been set for suspect. Victim 26 of the 2400 block of Ivy Avenue was found dead inside a vehicle in the 1600 block of East 25th Street at about 3:15 a.m. Wednesday. Victim's father, Norman Jones, said his son had much more of his life to live. It was a big shock, Jones said. No one wants to hear news like that. So, 3:19 a.m. on a Wednesday?
Yeah.
There's some rule that says that nothing good happens after midnight?
That is the rule. And the leading causes of death are minding your own business, just hanging around, and on your way to choir practice.
Yeah. Well, the suspect has only one conviction in his entire life.
Hmm.
For murder in the second degree.
Oh.
10/15/1993 felon class D.
Clearly.
Already convicted of second-degree murder, and now he's up on first-degree murder charges. He was sentenced to up to 50 years in prison on the second-degree murder conviction, and he was released from prison 4/19/2010, 16 years and 6 months after the murder. At the time of the first murder, he was almost, but not quite, 16 years old.
Now, this is actually interesting in a way, because usually the first crime you're convicted of is not murder. It's usually something you build up to.
Well, see, this is the first adult crime that we know of. Because
I
he
see.
Was almost 16. At the age of 16 in North Carolina, all felonies are treated as adult crimes. And if they want to, all of the misdemeanors can be treated as adult crimes too, but they can be treated as juvenile crimes. But prior to the age of 16, everything's a juvenile crime unless it's treated, in this case, like it was treated as an adult crime. So we have no idea what his juvenile crime record was.
Gotcha.
And I'm pretty sure he didn't wake up one day and say, I'm just going to kill this guy. I just don't see it.
Yeah, makes sense.
Victim, possessed, Schedule 2, 318-2005, misdemeanor class 1. Resisting officer, 318-2005, misdemeanor class 1. Common law robbery, 225-2009, felon class G. And this guy apparently got started when he was 17 or 18.
So it got started late in life.
We sometimes forget that free speech, real free speech, is pretty rare outside the United States. This week on Foreign Policy for Grownups, Nikki looks at the free speech fallout post-Charlie Hebdo. So Nikki, we've heard about the shooting in Texas after the Draw Muhammad contest was announced there. We've heard about the death threats to the organizer. And now is it true that there's even more controversy about free speech worldwide? I mean, why is this even an issue? Since when do we bow to bullies who want to shut us up?
Well, there are definitely a few things going on worldwide. After the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo came under attack for publishing cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad in January, the world seemed to stand on the side of free speech. I was really proud. My Twitter avatar to this day is still Je suis Charlie. I am Charlie in French. Unfortunately, that unity didn't last real long, and now all of a sudden Europeans are divided as to the true meaning of free speech. So this sociologist guy, whom Foreign Affairs calls, quote-unquote, the maverick, his name is Emmanuel Todd, published this book filled with all kinds of charts and data to justify his opinion that people standing together to honor free speech were nothing but a bunch of racist conservatives. Yep, that's right. That these demonstrations after the massacre in Paris, they weren't about liberté, égalité, and fraternité, but rather traditionalist, reactionary, evil Catholics. Now, okay, I'm not religious by any stretch. I'm about as atheist as they come. But to claim that the world standing together against wholesale slaughter of people who dare exercise their right to free expression is nothing but an excuse to promote racist religious fundamentalism strikes me as mental acrobatics worthy of Olga Corbett on the uneven bars. In other words, WTF? Come on. This Todd creature manages to also claim that solidarity with Charlie Hebdo represents, and I quote, a white-collar, white-skinned France, one that thrives on growing economic inequities and deepening social issues. In other words, them poor Muslims in France are all sorts of disenfranchised and marginalized, and racism, and privilege, and shut up, racist! Todd's book is apparently fairly successful in France, even though many French media outlets have pretty much given it the big fat middle finger. So, of course, Todd has gone on the offensive, calling those who criticize his pablum stupid and other choice monikers. So, after the French and the rest of the world stood so passionately together to honor free speech and protect it, French society seems to be kind of divided. Hell, they started arresting people for the horrible crime of exercising their free speech, otherwise known as inciting racial and religious hatred, before even the bodies of the folks massacred at Charlie Hebdo got cold, for Pete's sake.
Well, they're French, so it's not all that surprising. Their politics appear to run the full range between liberal and liberaler.
Liberaler, that's pretty impressive. Yeah, unfortunately, the French aren't the only ones. We're actually kind of divided as well here in the States. The Pen American Center, which is an organization that's dedicated to free expression and advancing literature, gave the editors of Charlie Hebdo an award for courage earlier this month at its gala. The response? Like 145 sniveling, cowardly capitulators whose idea of promoting free speech is only limited to non-offensive, bland, leftist, agree with us, you privileged white male swine, or we shall shun you type of expression, decided to protest the award. They apparently see it as a reward for being offensive. Wah. And even the Pope, yeah, that Pope, got into the controversy and implied that somehow freedom of speech should have its limits, that these cartoonists somehow deserve to be slaughtered because, well, if you insult my mommy, I'll punch you in the nose. Yeah, you know what? I've had just about enough of this. People who should be standing up and defending fundamental freedoms are whining about privilege and about how the tender sensibilities of terrorist scum should not be offended? Please, The Penn Award was not a reward for being offensive, as these writers claimed. It was a reward for standing up to terrorist bullies and not allowing them to threaten and shut you up. The organization is an association of writers and artists that's supposedly dedicated to working to ensure that people everywhere have the freedom to create literature, to convey information and ideas, to express their views, and to make it possible for everybody to access those views, ideas, and literature. And those views should include ideas that some may find offensive. Publishing under the threat of death, putting forth those ideas while knowing that a terrorist pig at any moment could slaughter you, that is pretty much the very definition of courage. That's what the award was about. And no, the mommy insult the Pope so inelegantly suggested deserves a punch in the face is unacceptable. While I may know that some folks will get violent if I insult their mother, that certainly doesn't mean they have the right to commit a violent act against me. There's no right not to be offended. There is, however, the right not to be physically attacked by pig-humping scum or anyone else because they got their panties in a wad about something or other. Charlie Hebdo was mocking Muhammad and specifically those who would murder in his name. They sure proved the magazine right, didn't they? The perpetually offended, quivering bottom lip set are a huge portion of the world's population. They're massive. How many Muslims are there in the world? A whole lot. It's not like they're an oppressed minority, for Pete's sake. Hell, many of their governments kill for the crime of blasphemy. And frankly, they're bullies, plain and simple. Many of them escape these oppressive environments and settle in nations that ostensibly protect freedom of expression. And then what do? They try to bully those nations into implementing the same oppressive laws they escaped because they happen to be offended. In other words, they try to turn their new homes into the same oppressive holes they left in the first place. Ugh. Freedom of speech and freedom of expression should never be controversial topics. The world should stand up for those ideals, not bow down to those who would destroy them.
All right, Nikki. It was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
You bet. Take care.
Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com.
And remember, it's racist to draw a cartoon, but it's not racist to assume that the subjects of that cartoon would become uncontrollably violent. Unless the person making that assumption is a Republican, in that case, racist.
Yep, sounds about right. Strange laws.
So, congratulations to Florida. Florida now has a new permitless carry law during emergencies. This just passed in the last week or so, and now Floridians can go strapped for 48 hours after the declaration of an emergency by the governor. So, that's, you know, something I think you guys had in North Carolina where
We had the reverse.
Yeah, like you couldn't carry at all.
Like, yeah, you couldn't take a gun outside your own house. You couldn't buy ammunition.
Yeah. So now Florida is, okay, well, anybody who can legally own a firearm can carry that firearm during a state of emergency. We've got a link in the show notes to an article that covers a lot of this stuff. The Sheriff's Association basically said, you know, this isn't really about concealed carry so much as it is about allowing people to transport their firearms rather than leave them in their homes to be looted later.
True. I like the title, Concealed Carry Law Leaves Unanswered Questions.
Well, that's always the case when a law that the media doesn't like gets passed. It's always confusing or has unanswered
controversial.
Questions. Controversial.
The new legislation, however, does not specify whether shelters must accept evacuees' firearms or provide secure containers in which to store them. Evacuation shelters are often located in places where firearms are already prohibited, such as public schools.
Breaking news, law about permitless carry doesn't cover things that aren't about permitless carry.
Yeah. It's like these people borrow trouble.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that here in Nashville when the park carry thing passed. Oh, well, what about this? Well, it's pretty clear to anybody who reads the law what the answer is. Thanks for playing.
You get the impression there's a lot of people out there who are just unable to handle ambiguity in any meaningful way.
Yes.
Well, this week, our special guest is our sponsor, Andrew Branca. Andrew is here to tell you why you need to learn about the laws of self-defense. So, Andrew, we've met. I've taken your class, but for our listeners, could you tell me a bit more about yourself?
Sure. I'm an attorney. I've specialized in self-defense law for about the last 18 years. My goal is to teach people the law of self-defense so that they're able to both win the tactical fight, the physical fight, as well as win the legal fight that follows. Our tagline is, you carry a gun so you're hard to kill, know the law so you're hard to convict. I should also mention I'm a lifelong member of the gun community, a master class competitor in IDPA, and I'm proud to say I played a very modest role in the founding of IDPA. My IDPA number is 13. I believe they're up over 25,000 members now.
Mine's much higher than 13. So how exactly do you go about teaching people the law of self-defense?
Well, we take a wide variety of approaches so that we can connect with the greatest variety of people. Our entry-level product, so to speak, is our book, The Law of Self-Defense, Second Edition. This teaches the general framework of self-defense law that's common across all 50 states, and it includes tables that cover the specific laws of each of those states. So in this way, the book covers all 50 states at a high level. Importantly, a key value of the book is that it's written in plain English for non-lawyers. It actually took us longer to translate all the legalese into English than it took us to do the research for 50 states' worth of self-defense laws. The single most common feedback we get on the book is that it's accessible and easy to understand for people who are not attorneys. So we call the book our entry-level product because the cost is only $20. That's the print cost for the book, whether from our website or from Amazon or from the NRA store or Gun Digest or lots of other places. If people like Kindle books, they can get it in Kindle version from Amazon for just $10. And if they're members of Amazon's Kindle Unlimited Borrowing Program, they can actually get the book for free. But if you want an autographed copy, and many people like to get an autographed copy, especially for gifts, the only place you can get those is from our website, lawofselfdefense.com. And when you go to checkout, just indicate in the notes at checkout what you'd like written in the book. We're happy to write just about anything.
Now, you also have the in-person seminar. I've taken that, and I've been recommending that to basically everybody who carries a gun.
Absolutely. The seminars are our next-level product above and beyond the book. The seminars are state-specific, meaning we take a deep dive into the self-defense statutes, jury instructions, and court decisions of the particular state in which the seminar is being held. We run those seminars all over the country in any state where enough people are interested to have a class. So far, we've held seminars at about half the states, and we expect we'll get the other half covered soon enough. Now, where the book covers all 50 states at a high level, the seminar spends about 5 hours really digging into the self-defense law of that specific state where we are giving the seminar. We also spend a lot of time working through various self-defense hypothetical situations so we can explore how the state will apply its self-defense law to those specific fact situations. Now, like the book, the seminar is perfectly appropriate to a non-lawyer audience, and most of our attendees are, in fact, not lawyers. Because of the extra detail and depth we cover in the seminar, there is a bit more legal terminology than the book, but we explain it all in plain English. The fact is, however, that after attending one of our law of self-defense seminars, you will know far more about the law of self-defense in that state and how it's applied to real people in real self-defense cases than just about any lawyer you'll run into. In fact, the legal quality of the seminars is so high that they're all certified for continuing legal education credit for practicing attorneys. And we get many defense attorneys, prosecutors, and even judges attending our seminars. It's literally the case that the law of self-defense seminars are where other lawyers come to learn self-defense law. Now, that said, for people who can't attend a live seminar for scheduling reasons or we don't have one in their state yet, we also have many of these translated into online seminar versions that can be accessed from the convenience of a computer, a tablet, or even a smartphone. And that way they can watch the seminar content online at their convenience.
I've noticed on your blog you're now posting something you call the Law of Self-Defense Weekly Law Reports. And what's that about?
We just started doing those this month, actually. As you can imagine, we're constantly doing legal research in our office to keep up to date on the self-defense laws in all 50 states. Because we already do that research on a weekly basis for our own internal purposes, we've decided we may as well package it up and make it available to the general public for free through our blog, which is simply lawofselfdefense.com/blog. So every week, we look at all the newest self-defense court cases that have been decided across the country. We choose the more interesting of those, and we package them into an abridged form in our weekly law report. Now, I caution that we do not spend a lot of time translating these cases into plain English, unlike what we do with the book and the seminar. But instead, we leave the cases in the legalese in which they're written by the courts. Because of this, they can be hard to get much value out of if you don't already generally understand the principles of self-defense law. Now, anyone who's read the book, The Law of Self-Defense, Second Edition, or who's attended a seminar or taken one of the online courses should have no trouble understanding the weekly law reports. So we really think of these reports as a graduate-level product.
Andrew, why do I need to know all this stuff? I mean, a good shoot is a good shoot. Why do I need to spend 5 hours in a class learning all this stuff from you?
Well, it's absolutely true that a good shoot is a good shoot. It's equally true that a bad shoot is a bad shoot. Where we see otherwise law-abiding people get in trouble over a use of force incident is not generally where they've acted from malice, but only because they've made a legal mistake out of ignorance of the law, out of not knowing the rules of the game. And those mistakes, if they're made, are permanent. We lawyers have to take our clients as they come to us. We don't have a time machine that lets us go back to the fight and change the facts. If the facts are that the defender violated one of the five elements of the law of self-defense, then that's that. There's not much we can do for them other than force the state to prove its case. Far better for the defender is to have known the five elements of the law of self-defense beforehand and to have built them into his self-defense tactics. That way he has a much higher probability of ensuring that his shoot is a good shoot and a much lower probability of spending the rest of his productive life in jail.
All right, you just talked about the five elements of the law of self-defense. Can you explain what those five elements are and what's the legal implications of violating them?
Sure. In every state, a legal claim of self-defense consists of five potential elements: innocence, imminence, proportionality, reasonableness, and avoidance. It's very important to understand that these are cumulative, and for a claim of self-defense to survive, none of these can be violated, not even one. You can think of them as the links of a chain. If any one of them is broken, your claim of self-defense fails, period. And if your claim of self-defense fails, you're in easy conviction. Because in order to claim self-defense in the first place, you have to admit to the underlying use of force. In essence, you're saying, yes, I shot that person, yes, they died, but I had legal justification for doing so, self-defense. If you lose the self-defense justification, all that's left of that sentence is a confession. And the prosecutor knows exactly what he has to do to defeat your claim of self-defense and get you convicted. He has to disprove any one of those five elements. Of course, by disprove, we don't mean he has to have some absolute proof that you violated one of them. What we really mean is he simply has to convince the jury that you broke one of them. Trials are not about absolute truth. Nobody ever knows what the absolute truth was. Trials are about stories or narratives that each side, the prosecution and defense, tells the jury about what happened. So, for example, you can lose on the element of innocence if you were actually the aggressor in the fight, or if the prosecutor can make it look as if you were the aggressor in the fight. And if you lose on the element of innocence, you lose self-defense. And if you lose self-defense, you're in easy conviction, as we just discussed. And this same idea applies to all five of the elements of the law of self-defense. What we try to teach our students, then, is to understand these five elements in such a way that they can design their own customized, legally sound self-defense strategy that allows them to tactically defend themselves while minimizing their vulnerability to prosecution.
All right, now, we both know that if I have to shoot somebody, even in the most obvious case of legal self-defense, the cops are about certain to arrest me. Can you come be my lawyer?
I probably wouldn't be. A lot of our work is helping out people who are targets or prospective targets of prosecution for having used force in self-defense. Having said that, I almost never take direct clients anymore. So you definitely should not be calling me first. Instead, if you're in this situation, you should retain competent legal counsel that is licensed to practice in your state. Then you would discuss with your lead counsel whether you would both like to explore having me help on your case. If you both agree, your lawyer, not you, but your lawyer, would give me a call. Now, the typical first step in that call is the lawyer and I agree upon a small initial retainer agreement that covers just a single hour of consultation, and that's billed at my usually hourly rate, which currently is $450 an hour. And it usually only takes that first hour to determine whether or not I can be useful on the case or not. By the way, I should mention, anyone who's listening, or who in the future may be a graduate of one of my seminars, or who has participated in one of the online training courses, that first hour consultation for them is free, rather than being billed at my hourly rate. Now, if after that hour, you and your lawyer mutually agree that I can be useful to the case, we'll sign a more comprehensive retainer agreement and I'm officially on your case. But in that event, my client is your lawyer, not you. I deliver my work product to your lawyer, who then determines in his own professional judgment how to integrate it into your case. So in short, I'm consulting to him, and he's providing legal advice to you. That's how I can legally advise on your case without having to be licensed to practice law in all 50 states.
All right, so how can people read more from you?
Well, there are a lot of places people can do that for free. I do a lot of blogging on the well-respected legal blog run out of Cornell Law School, legalinsurrection.com. That's where I generally cover the big self-defense cases, as I did the Zimmerman trial. I also have my own blog, of course, as I mentioned, lawofselfdefense.com/blog. I also do occasional video casts on YouTube and podcasts available from iTunes and Stitcher and other sources. And the easiest way to find either the video casts or podcasts is, again, just from my website, lawofselfdefense.com. Finally, I do a lot of speaking appearances, both live and over the radio and internet. I was a featured speaker at the NRA annual meeting in 2014, for example, and of course, I'm on this podcast with you now, Sean.
All right, Andrew, it was good to talk to you. See you again soon.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
You can find Andrew at lawofselfdefense.com. And remember to use discount code VARIETY at checkout for 10% off anything you buy. Fun with headlines.
So, Sean, you sent me this one, and I think my response to your email was pretty colorful. Here's the headline. Arkansas officers shoot cuffed man in patrol car.
Those jerks!
Now, that is pretty inflammatory, particularly because of what's going on, you know, contemporary to when we're recording this podcast. Baltimore has just been on fire because of riots, because of police brutality. Ferguson happened earlier this year. There's all kinds of, you know, police brutality stuff that's going on. And, you know, oh my gosh, why did they have to shoot that man? So when you see something like this, you're like, what is going on? Well, let me tell you what's going on. A handcuffed parolee who had been frisked for a weapon opened fire on law enforcement officers from the back of a patrol car in central Arkansas, provoking a return of gunfire that left him dead, a corrections official said. Yeah. Okay. How about, as a headline, felon obtains firearm and opens fire on police officers from their own patrol car?
Yeah. Not only was this guy, you know, in custody, he was in custody for violating his parole for a previous firearm possession conviction.
Yes, of course he was.
McIntosh was set to finish parole July 2nd and had caused little trouble for law enforcement while in the correction system, Tyler said. He was employed and had no disciplinary action in prison since his parole September 2014. He wasn't allowed to possess firearms due to a previous conviction, including drug possession and theft by receiving. So, yeah, this guy was absolutely not allowed to have a gun, and he probably really shouldn't have had a gun after he'd been cuffed and frisked. But quite frankly, if you take a shot at a police officer, you can't complain if he shoots you back.
Right.
Have you noticed that computers seem to last a bit longer before they stop being able to run your favorite programs? Well, Baron joins us from his secret hidden bunker to tell us why that is in
Tech Tips.
Tech Tips.
Tech Tips.
You are damaging my calm.
Tech Tips with the Baron.
Baron, why are people no longer buying new computers? And how come all of them seem to be these tablet things?
Well, you see, in the early days of computers, the effect of Moore's Law was very, very pronounced. So much so that it was 18 months to 2 years, and your hardware was very old and outdated. So much so that new games and even some general purpose software wouldn't even run on the older hardware.
Okay, Moore's Law, that was the law that your computer was going to double in processing power every 18 months or something?
That's the way most people know it. It's actually that the price per transistor would be cut in half, and you'd basically also be doubling. So for the price you paid, you would get double the horsepower.
Oh, okay.
And as time moved forward into about mid-2000s, it started hitting a plateau for general computing, very much so right about 2010. And while hardware is still improving by leaps and bounds, the average person's needs for general computing is no longer really increasing. So in that growth coming up, you would constantly be finding new purposes and new things that you could do with the computer. Oh, I'm going to do video editing. I'm going to do photo editing. I'm going to do this, that, or the other thing. Well, all of those needs have been pretty much met at this point, and people aren't really adding new things to them. And so your general purpose hardware, where it used to die after, you know, 18 months to the 2 years, it can last 4 years or longer. My last computers lasted 6+ years. I actually still have the desktop I use for other things. It's just not my daily driver anymore. But back to the average people, most of them are doing emails, bills, account tracking, and other just basic general tasks, which in the grand scheme of things are actually more easily dealt with on a tablet.
So a lot of the stuff that most people do is just on the internet. And I guess you're right. Just you could, if you're just accessing the internet, a tablet will work. But why are vendors pushing tablets so much?
Well, because they don't really understand that general computing is not going to go away. And as the specs for computers today roughly match the specs from 3 years ago, with some very minor differences, the money that people would normally be spending on buying a new computer, that's now extra cash in their pocket, and they can go buy a new toy, such as a tablet. And the industry folks stupidly thought this meant everyone was ditching their computers and moving to tablets for everything they do, when really their computers were still there and functional. And ultimately, Microsoft was the best example of going full retard when they released Windows 8, causing more people to not even want to buy a new computer because they didn't want to deal with Windows 8. They suppressed the sales even more because people were, they're wanting to ride out the Windows 8 fiasco. So here's a quick tip. If you have a computer and it has at least a multi-core processor, preferably 4 cores or more, and at least 8 gigabytes of RAM, preferably 16, and it feels sluggish, just go buy a solid-state hard drive and replace your current old hard drive. Use that for your OS. Your computer will unbelievably improve in performance because, well, that's really what your choke point is the bus bandwidth between your old hard drive and your computer.
Well, what if I'm stuck with this Windows 8 stuff, though?
The good news is, and I have to thank Chris Byrne on this one because I wasn't even aware of its existence until he told me, there is a add-in called Classic Shell, which you can install onto Windows 8, and it basically turns it into the Windows 7 user interface with all the under-the-hood advancements of Windows 8.
Because Windows 8 actually isn't bad. There's a lot of improvements to it, but God, the interface is terrible.
The interface is absolutely abysmal.
Okay, so basically if I put Classic Shell in, you're telling me that what I'll get is it'll look just like Windows 7, but I'll get all the pluses that Windows 8 comes with.
That is correct. I don't know if Microsoft is going to wake up to the fiasco that was Windows 8 and with Windows 10 move back from the attitude that everything is going to be a tablet and touchscreen interface, but general computing isn't going anywhere. And it's obvious it's not going anywhere because you can see the proof in Apple sales for their MacBook and Mac Pro lines. Many who hit their moment of growth in this Windows 8 fiasco have actually crossed to the dark side and bought a Mac, because they still have to satisfy their general computing needs.
All right, Baron. It was good to talk to you. I'll see you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
So that's one of those things that's like completely self-evident once you hear it, but I had no, like it didn't occur to me. So yeah, I bought a convertible tablet thingy like 18 months ago thinking, oh yay, tablet. Yeah, I never convert it to a tablet. I always use it like a laptop.
Oh yeah, those things where you turn it around and close it up and like it's a giant, really heavy tablet.
Yeah, well mine's got a button. It's called the Asus Transformer. And so it's got like the keyboard. It does like that whole like Starship Enterprise thing where it like disconnects and docks and stuff. But I just leave it docked all the time.
Yeah, seriously. Tablets and phones are consumer devices. You're consuming something, you know, whether that's music or, you know, stuff on the internet, you know, stuff you're reading, stuff you're listening to, stuff you're watching. If you need to produce something, you need an actual computer to do this. Whether or not your tablet has the horsepower to do it is not really important. What it doesn't have is the input devices.
Right.
You just can't work that way. I mean, somebody, what is it, the monkey arm problem?
You know what I'm talking about? No.
There's a concept in computing. It's something along the lines of the monkey problem, the monkey arm problem. It's you can't look at something and use your hands on it to manipulate it at the same time as an input device. A touchscreen on a computer is a really awkward thing to hold your arm out and work with, but a touchscreen on the table flat is really easy to work with. The problem is the touchscreen on the table, which is easy to work with finger-wise, is a real pain in the neck, literally, to look at.
Yes, I can see that.
So what you've got is the computer has solved this problem by putting your input devices flat on the table, your keyboard, your mouse, and putting your visual readout vertically so that you can see it.
Yes.
And a tablet really doesn't allow you to input a lot of information. That's why it's used for consuming stuff.
Yeah, and I'd also like to add that the link that Baron gave for the server store, I just visited there and saw some servers that my company paid about $13,000 for on sale for $1,000. So, yeah, I'm going to be spending some money.
Cool. The J-Block. Have you heard about the Charlie Challenge?
Even not being on Facebook, Twitter, or any other social media, I have somehow managed to hear about this.
I had, I swear, the dumbest Facebook encounter on this one. It just left me wanting to choke people. For those who've not heard of this, I'm sorry to mess up your life by talking about it. It is this dumb thing that kids are doing. They draw a little square on a piece of cardboard or a piece of paper. They take two pencils and they balance them in a cross, a little X, and they pretend that they're summoning a demon, a Mexican demon named Charlie.
Could figure that one out.
Then the pencil will move to indicate an answer. Okay, I got a couple of problems with this. The first one, what kind of Mexican demon spirit answers to the name of Charlie? I mean, seriously.
Yeah, I don't know. Chupacabra, maybe.
Yeah.
But not Charlie.
You know, Jose. I mean, seriously. I mean, is this some weird version of anti-cultural appropriation?
I don't even know.
Cultural projection? I don't know. Number two, divination's a crock. It doesn't work. Just like every other type of psychic powers. You know how I know there's no psychic powers? Because there's this guy named James Randi who's just begging for a chance to give you $1 million if you can prove you have any type of psychic powers at all. At all. If you can prove it, he's got $1 million with your name on it.
Well, let me just get on that.
Seriously. There are people all over the world who claim they have psychic powers, but no one since 1964, no one has successfully demonstrated any of these paranormal powers. Now, you know, oh, well, maybe they're not interested in the money. Oh, get real. So let's say you could play a saxophone. I mean, not even very well, but you could play a tune. Some guy offers you $1 million. He says, there is no way anybody can play this crazy instrument. If you can play this, you can satisfy me that you can actually play something that approaches a tune with this crazy, stupid instrument, I will give you $1 million. You're telling me that nobody who can play a saxophone is going to take him up on that? Nobody's going to go inside and play a tune in laboratory conditions? No, it isn't going to happen. There's somebody out there who wants $1 million enough that they're going to demonstrate. And since 1964, nobody has demonstrated anything to Randy's satisfaction. So guess what? It doesn't exist. If you believe this crap, you're wrong. Get your head straight. Now, it's not the people who believe in this garbage that bothers me. I mean, there's just people believe in the dumbest things.
There are stupid people.
I see
stupid people.
It's the radical Christians who are making a big deal about this. Oh my God, they're summoning demons! Like, exclamation point, 11D. I had a bad Facebook exchange with some people on this. People who act like this are embarrassing Christians. Please stop. Just stop now. Feel free to swat your kid upside the head for being gullible and stupid, but give it a rest with this whole summoning demons garbage. Ouija boards, this stupid pencil thing. I mean, everybody knows how this works. I can understand if people believe this stuff in the days before YouTube, but when you can go on YouTube and watch how Penn and Teller bust the Ouija board and you still believe that Ouija boards are real, there's something wrong with you. I mean, this is like chemtrail level dumb. It doesn't work that way. Give it a rest. This week, Weird points out how moms demand illegal mayors for every town, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, is filled with Stepford wives willing to lie to legislators to get their way. In
This Week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
So hey Weird, how's it going?
It's going good, Sean. Hey, remember how last week we were talking about moms demand illegal mayors for every town in America hating on Texas open carry?
We talked about that and North Carolina. So what's going on in Texas now?
Well, they had a Senate hearing and Bloomberg's drones are still attacking open carry and campus carry. So you can watch the whole hearing. I've got a link here in the show notes. And if you don't feel like sitting through the whole thing, though, it's only like an hour and a half. The Bloomberg drones are super easy to pick out because they're all wearing the same shirts. And essentially, they're all saying the exact same thing. I also put a link to a video where they cut together all of them saying the exact same thing over and over and over again.
Oh my, yeah, seriously. Somebody pointed out that this was a live in-person denial of service attack.
Ooh. So a bunch of them had some, you know, very basic bad arguments. Open carry is a bad policy. Yeah, of course it is, because that's why the majority of states have some form of open carry and have no problem with it. Let's see, the Waco biker gang shootout would have been worse because of open carry. Yeah, I don't think those guys are going to have problems. And of course, also, there's the potential of the, was it the biker gangs that did the most damage or the police?
Yeah, there's a good question there.
Let's see, campus carry is a bad idea because we'll have drunk kids shooting themselves on campus. Again, there's no problem with the other campuses that have that. And again, the type of people that are going to carry on campus are not the same people doing keg stands.
It's also true.
The best one, though, that really kind of knocked my socks off before we get to the really good one. So second best, the second prize is racist cops harassing black open carriers, but not white ones. Yeah, so you're going to just say, well, let's not have open carry because we have racist cops. You know, racist cops can do a lot more damage than just harassing black people who are open carrying, because black people do a whole lot more things. And if you got cops that hate black people, then I don't think the blacks are safe if they just don't carry a gun.
You know, it's hard to argue with that logic, Weird.
All right, still the whopper. I decided to cut out a clip of it because I don't think anyone would believe me if I just read a transcript.
Hi, my name is Leslie Irvin, and I'm a supporter of Moms Demand Gun Sense in America. My son Lex is paranoid schizophrenic. On his 18th birthday, he decided that he wanted to purchase firearms. I had no idea of this. I got a call from McBride's Gun Shop in Austin, Texas, a locally owned store, that called me and said that my son did not appear stable and they refused to sell him a gun. I was really happy because I thought that this was the way the system worked. I called up the Austin Police Department and they came over because I wanted to make sure that my son would not be allowed to purchase more firearms. And they told me that it was his right. Lex went on to buy an arsenal of guns from the big box stores, and there was nothing I could do to stop them. They told me that it was his right, and I needed a court order to prevent him from purchasing firearms. In order to get a court order, I needed an incident. On September 18th, 2013, my son Lex killed his dad.
So, Sean, what does that sound like to you?
Wow, the poor lady, you know, she tried to keep her kid away from guns, and he got a gun anyway, no matter what she tried, and then he used that gun to murder her husband.
You know, that is exactly what it sounds like. Unfortunately, that's not what happened. I guess he got guns. So honestly speaking, I can't find any confirmation of that. But again, she's 100% correct in the fact that there's no way she could have kept him from getting guns because he had never been arrested or had any sort of criminal interactions as far as his mental illness concerns. But no, he killed his father with a pipe wrench and a pocket knife.
It's a good thing he didn't have any guns then. It could have been worse. Could have been like really dead.
Yeah. Well, she later mentions in her testimony that's not in the clip that I posted that she was concerned that possibly after she had beaten and stabbed her husband to death, he might have gone and gotten his guns and done some horrible things. But again, that's not what he did. So now another interesting thing to note is that her son was found not guilty by reason of insanity. And it's since been adjudicated on, but I can't find the records and I didn't really dig into the court files, but I don't know if he's going to be committed for the rest of his life or if maybe he's going to be committed for a little while and then released again, which kind of scares me because I've known a bunch of people that are severely mentally ill. And, you know, it's sad and horrible, but none of them have hurt anybody. Or if they have, it's all been minor, you know, minor business. No one's definitely ever murdered somebody because they thought they were a CIA imposter or whatever lunacy he was going on. And I think it's a big gap to suddenly go over to suddenly start murdering people. Either way, if you live in Texas, contact your representatives and ask them to support open carry and campus carry because it's both a good law and the worst people hate it.
All right, Weird. It was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
See you next week, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host at The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com.
Okay, see, that's the thing, right? If things were truly the way that Bloomberg and his people said that they were, then they'd have a lot of support. I would probably support them if all of the awful things that they say happen actually happened. You know, last week you guys played an ad where they said that if the pistol purchase permit system was replaced with a federal NICS check, that was eliminating background checks on handguns. They lie. Period. Full stop. That's all they do.
That's true. If what they said was true, you're right. Everybody'd support them.
Right.
But the minute you look into anything that they say, you find out it's just so BS that, I mean, you can't believe anybody with a straight face said this.
I mean, they only talk in fun with headlines speak.
Seriously. Stuff that grinds my gears. Do you have any idea how serious the fine is for passing a stopped school bus?
What is it, like $150? $300?
No, in North Carolina, it's a class 1 misdemeanor with a minimum $500 fine.
And what is a class 1 misdemeanor? That's like the low one, right? That's...
No, class 3 is the low misdemeanor. Class A1 misdemeanor is the most serious thing that you can do without it being a felony. If you, as a male, assault a female, that's a class A1 misdemeanor. If she assaults you, that's a class 1 misdemeanor.
Because that's fair.
Right. And if, you know, two men punch each other out, that's class 1 misdemeanor. So, you know, this is as serious as it gets, basically, without it being a felony. And now they're complaining, oh, we've got cameras on some of these buses to catch people who were driving past, but we can't prove who the driver is, so we need to change the law so that it's the registered owner of the vehicle unless he can prove it's somebody else.
So what you're saying is that when I go visit you in North Carolina, I can borrow your car and get you a class 1 misdemeanor on your record.
Theoretically, yes. I think I've, you know, previously said that there's the two things that are messing up America worse than anything else. Number one is the income tax, and number two is school crossing guards. We are building a system where we are training children that they are so important that the entire rest of the world will come to a screeching freaking halt so that they can get on and off their bus or cross the street to get to school without the slightest possibility of anything negative happening to them. When I was a child, if I was to ever get hit by a car and killed, I was also going to get a spanking. I was absolutely convinced that getting run over by the car was not the bad part. It was the spanking that was coming afterwards for being in the street where I didn't belong.
Ding, ding, ding.
You drive kids from one place to another in a bus. It is your responsibility not to put them in a dangerous place, in a dangerous situation. And what we're seeing is these bus drivers, instead of pulling into a side street where the houses are, they're stopping on main roads and they're forcing entire main roads to stop. We've got a road that's, you know, it's half a mile from here. It's the main drag north and south. It's not the, you know, the main highway, you know, two lanes in each direction, four lanes total with a big, you know, center divider. It's not that one, but it is a main north-south route. It's the route that anybody who lives here would use to go into the south side of Raleigh. It's a lane in each direction, and it's got a painted median in it, you know, a suicide lane.
Mm-hmm.
And they will stop the bus in the middle of this road, throw out their barrier, and turn on the lights, and children will cross this major freaking road to get onto the bus. What kind of idiotic crap is that? Why are you picking up children in these circumstances? Pull into a side road, or, you know, drive both directions on that road and pick them up. I have to stop because, you know, if there's no real median, you know, an actual grass median with or, you know, a built up cement median or a jersey wall, unless it's that serious, then they expect children to be able to cross these roads. And they wonder why people don't want to stop for buses. Duh. If you make it so miserable and inconvenient for everybody, there's a certain percentage of people who are just going to do what they're going to do. And that's how little kids get run over. But if you set up the situation in the first place so the little kids don't have to put themselves in danger, maybe you make it a little more inconvenient for the bus driver and a little more convenient for the child and a little more convenient for the rest of the people on the planet, then maybe people won't be passing the buses so much. But no, what really ends up happening is you just make it as difficult as possible for everybody because, you know, we don't want the bus driver to have to drive both directions on the same road, which he has to do anyway because he has to start from one end and come this way.
Yeah, so this reminds me a lot of if you or I put a hot dog on the kitchen counter and tell our dogs to not eat the hot dog versus putting the hot dog in a plastic container and then putting that in the microwave, right?
Yeah, seriously.
You know, there's things that you can solve with a process and things that you can solve with a law, and this would probably be better solved by a process.
Yeah, okay. You know, if anybody who does hazard awareness, you know, anybody who works in any sort of a dangerous environment, has got hazard awareness training, there's three systems you can use. You can wear PPE. I wear gloves.
Mm-hmm.
That's your last line of defense. That's if nothing else works.
PPE would be personal protection equipment?
Yes, that's correct. PPE. Okay. Or you can build a guard around the dangerous thing so it's impossible for you to stick your fingers in it in the first place.
Ding.
There you go. But no, they don't want to do that. They want to make it as easy as possible for the bus driver and as miserable for everybody else as possible. And then they wonder why people have such low regard for the laws that they pass.
But see, I think the thing that you're missing is that bus driver is a government employee and you are not.
And it's for the children.
Yes, but mostly for the bus driver.
So what you got this week?
Hey, Sean, does your wife ever do something that annoys you?
No, my wife never does anything ever that annoys me. And if you've ever heard me say otherwise, it was a figment of your imagination.
Well, good, because if she ever did anything that annoys you, you should get a divorce. Period. The end. I actually had a guy tell me that one time. I was saying something about my wife not being on time for anything. And he was like, well, if that bothers you, then you should just get a divorce. And I was like, I'm sorry, what? No.
This is a bit like saying, well, my baby needs the diaper changed. Oh, well, you should probably throw that baby away and get a new one.
Yes, it's much like that. So, yeah, I get unhelpful suggestions sometimes. And these really, you know, I don't know if they get, I don't know if they're being serious. I don't know if they're being cute. But, you know, when someone is asking for, hey, maybe somebody else has some ideas as to how I can solve this problem, throwing something out there like, oh, you should get your customer to spend $300 million to upgrade their operating systems so that you don't have to use this function. I mean, it's like, what? It gets inside my OODA loop to throw one back to last episode. It's like, what?
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry. What?
So you're saying that they need a sarcasm tag?
I think so. I need like a real life sarcasm tag. And then I need that to not happen anymore. Just if you're going to turn on the sarc tags, just stop.
I guess I better never speak to you again. It's probably why you're not on Facebook anymore.
That's probably why I'm not on Facebook. Yeah.
I think I'm like the king of unhelpful suggestions, but I try to be funny. You should laugh at them because they are funny, but I wouldn't say get a divorce.
Right. Because that's not funny.
So, live action sarcasm tags, and if you happen to want to use the sarcasm tag on Adam, just don't say anything at all.
Yeah. Just go full Thumper. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all.
Oh, I didn't know Thumper said that.
Bambi.
I don't have children.
You were a child at one point.
Yes, but I don't think I watched Bambi. I was a child before they had video, okay?
Bambi's from like the 30s.
They didn't have VHS when I was young enough to watch Bambi.
Okay.
Okay. Not only did they have it, for the longest time, Disney would put out a video for a couple of months and then discontinue it.
They still do that.
Yes, but you can still get it on eBay or something, or Amazon.
Or Torrent.
Or whatever.
I mean, so I've heard.
Yeah. Well, before we get into any more trouble, well, that's our show for the week. Thanks again to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at SeanSorrentino.com and hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. Show notes can be found at GunblogVarietyCast.com/episode 41.